Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High. You may have noted that we've been broadcasting on a weekly basis over the past 2 months. We'll continue to do so through the month of February. We've had a lot of great content in our Education Technology Innovation series, featuring the CEOs and founders of a variety of massive open online courses, or MOOCs, and other education innovators. We continue the series with my conversation with Umar Saif. Umar is the Vice Chancellor of the Information Technology University in Pakistan, a newly created university that aims to implement a unique teaching methodology and cross-disciplinary research that's grounded in real-world problem-solving to educate the next generation of innovative and entrepreneurial engineers. Umar has an ideal background for this, having spent time both in academia and in the startup setting. Prior to his current role, Umar was an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science at the Lahore University of Management Sciences, or LUMS. He's also the founder of one of the first startup incubators in Lahore, Pakistan, called SCI. He's worked on a number of startups, including SMSAll, Bumpin.com, CNReport.com, and TicketMy.com. Umar was named one of the top 35 young innovators in the world in 2011. He was selected as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum in 2010. He also received the Google Faculty Research Award in 2011 and the MIT Technovator Award in 2008, among many other accolades. Umar has a Bachelor of Science degree from LUMS, a PhD from the University of Cambridge, and a postdoctorate from MIT, all in computer science. A number of weeks ago, I spoke with Umar in his office in Lahore at LUMS. He was on the cusp of his departure for the Information Technology University, so our conversation didn't cover the new post, but focused on the research and work at LUMS, as well as his involvement in the startup community. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as he discussed fostering a culture of entrepreneurship in Pakistan. Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as he spoke about developing technology to solve the bigger needs and pent-up demand that he sees in Pakistan, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com.
Let me begin. You are a native Pakistani, where you are today, in fact, in Lahore, and you've spent time in the UK, here in the United States, at some of the best institutions in the world. You now are at one of the best institutions in Pakistan, the Lahore University of Management Sciences, or LUMS. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your journey. For instance, was it always your intent and desire to return to your native Pakistan? What did you glean from your experiences in the various geographies where you've been educated and where you've gained professional experience, and how do you see taking that back to your native country?
So some part of that answer is sort of not glamorous, but maybe some part of that is. So I did my undergrad from Pakistan, from LUMS, a university that I currently work in. It was a very new school then. I was in the second batch of undergraduate program that they just started, and no one really knew about them. And it just happened eventually also became sort of the first kid to go out and finish a PhD. So when I started at LUMS, I decided out as an economics major for various reasons, but was very quickly just mesmerized by IT, you know, just by being able to sit down, think up a recipe, write a bit of code, and actually see the damn thing work. You know, that was just fascinating to me. And that just got me hooked on to computer science. And very quickly, I realized that I want to do graduate school in computer science. So as soon as I finished my undergraduate, I applied to MIT, from where I was turned down, and had not applied to any of the school. I get my admiration for MIT, but also a misplaced trust in my ability to get in. So they promptly rejected me, and then I missed all their deadlines. But deadlines for Europe were still, they're a few months late in the cycle. So I think I was visiting college one of these days and met one of my professors, and he said you should apply to Cambridge, and it's not typically a place, you know, European universities are not places that you would typically associate with a graduate school in computer science, for instance. For computer science, you think of Stanford's and MIT's and Berkeley's and so on. But I did end up applying to Cambridge and looked at their program and what they've done, and was pleasantly surprised at their focus on also building stuff and all the big companies and innovations that have come out of the computer science lab in at Cambridge. So I applied there, got in, and then those were just very, very good 3 years. The thing in Oxford or Cambridge is that you get straight into a research-based graduate program. You don't have to go through a taught program. So you can theoretically finish a PhD in 3 years, which is the minimum residency requirement. So when I went there, I started work on an operating system, which was at the time, you know, was designed largely for multimedia applications. I started working on other aspects of this and eventually did sort of extensible version of that, which one could adapt based on the environment. And that became my PhD thesis. And it just so happened that because I identified the problem early, I had a good advisor to work with. I was surrounded with such a great set of real hardcore techies who would, you know, write kernel code with their eyes closed. I learned a lot in those 3 years and sort of finished my PhD within that time frame. When I started my grad school, I'd just done my undergrad, and just going through just a set of sliding doors earlier in life, I sort of started my undergraduate when I was just 16. I was done with it when I was 19, and then got into a graduate program and finished my graduate program in another 3 years. So I was just 22 when I was kind of done with my PhD, and as one of my professors put it, you know, that's when the dog catches up with the car. So you've been running after this car, you know, with all your enthusiasm, and finally catch up with the car and don't know what to do with it. But that's when I finished my PhD. But I wanted to, you know, sort of then pursue a career in academia, and again sort of apply to MIT for a postdoctorate position. And shortly after, you know, joined a research group at MIT called Project Oxygen, which was a large project. I think they did close to $45 million. At that time, it was actually the largest that the computer science lab at MIT had done, and had a huge consortium of large IT companies that they were working with. And the goal was simple, but also exciting. The goal was that what if, you know, computing was as ubiquitous as oxygen, and hence the name of the project. So how would the computing devices and the networks and so on will evolve? And Anant Agarwal was actually one of the leaders of Oxygen as part of the core team. I joined a small group that Anant was heading himself and started working on various things in Oxygen. And that was also a very, very exciting time. I enjoyed building stuff. You know, I'm sort of a, very much a product guy. That's the thing that got me hooked onto computer science, and that's the thing that that I found was the key strength at Cambridge and MIT. In fact, you know, at MIT, people frowned upon, you know, graduate students, postdocs, faculty writing papers about things that haven't actually been used by the people. And that was great, you know, and that was one thing that has stuck with me, that I must build stuff that other people can use before it becomes real research for me. And that then inevitably also leads to, you know, a degree of entrepreneurship where, because these things are actually useful by other people, they're the typically business models that you can build around them and spin them off into startups. And that's maybe the reason why Cambridge and MIT and other universities who have this philosophy of building stuff and having real people use it before you can write research papers on them have so many startups coming out of these universities. So these are kind of experiences that have stayed with me in terms of being totally focused on, one, identifying problems and sort of develop a taste of identifying problems where you can have large impact. And to quote one of the professors at MIT who I worked with very closely, sort of, I'm not a bit-whittling type of researcher. So I don't enjoy doing 2% or 10% improvements over what already works and get a stream of papers out of it. I would rather go after risky, edgy ideas, most of which might fail, but maybe have one or two home runs, so to speak, and sort of build a career, you know, looking for these home runs. And that's also something that was hammered into me at MIT, that, you know, you'll get tenure or you'll get hired once you have done things that you'll be remembered for, not things that you publish. And again, to quote one of the professors at MIT, was that don't assume that tenure committees can only count but not read. So it's not that they only count your papers, they also get to read your papers. So you must be very focused on maybe publishing even one paper every 5 years. That's a home run. That sort of, you know, sort of does edgy, fundamentally new work and opens up new avenues. And if you fail in that pursuit, maybe over and over again, that's totally acceptable. So I think sort of that's the philosophy that has stayed with me and sort of colors everything that I've done since.
That's really excellent. Can you talk a bit about the bridge between your time at MIT and your return to Pakistan?
You know, the way that unfolded is that I was talking to one of the mentors at MIT, who was the director of the lab. And I had a conversation with him where I was going about all the things that I was doing. And he said, you know, you may have your iron in too many fires. You know, what is it that you would like to achieve in your life? And the way he put that question was, assume that you can close your eyes, wave a magic wand, and make anything happen. If that was the case, where would you like to be in 10 years' time? And it turns out that's a deceptively simple question. Actually, that's a very, very hard question to answer. Most of us are kind of hostages to our circumstances. We are doing well in what we currently look at. We somehow ended up on a street and started running really fast and started competing with other people. And some people started doing really well, but they never really look at this bigger picture that what if they had a magic wand that they can wave? Hence, none of those circumstances, none of these things affect anymore what is it that you want to do in your life. If that was the case, what is it that you would want to do ideally? And I started thinking about that question at that time. I think it took me about a couple of months to, you know, find some answer to that question. And the answer was that I really want to go back to Pakistan and contribute to actually improving this country. And that, I think, sort of was a real eye-opener for me because I'd never really thought of it that way. I was just pursuing various things without realizing that this is what I eventually want to do. So that eventually then sort of put things in motion, and it took me about a year and a half from that time to align up things in Pakistan and arrive here. And by the way, I arrived in Pakistan without a job. You know, sort of I had applied to university alums at that time, but in the hiring cycle, they had not just gotten down to, you know, making me an offer at that time. So I actually arrived in Pakistan without having a job lined up, but at least some belief that that I'll be able to do interesting things here.
That's excellent. And you obviously did find your way back to LUMS. And I'm curious, clearly your time at MIT had such an impression that you looked to replicate a comparable set of experiences at LUMS. And I'm wondering how your original ideas to the university were met. Were these immediately greeted as very logical pursuits, or did it take some convincing to develop this kind of foot in academe, foot in entrepreneurship? How was that greeted?
Well, one of the things I realized, I mean, you often tell this story, is that, you know, because I did my grad school at Cambridge, you know, that's sort of a campus that sprawls in an entire city. And I remember the first day I arrived at MIT, and the cab driver dropped me off on Main Street on the other side of Marriott. And I asked him where MIT is, and he said, just go through this hotel, through this revolving door, and the other side you'll come out on a street, and MIT is just about there. And it turns out, you know, it's just a set of random rented buildings on a random street. And I was very underwhelmed with the campus. You know, to compare that to Cambridge, where everything was so formal, laid out, you know, there wasn't a wall that wasn't built 500 years ago and had a history to it and so on. And here you were in a world-class university, at least, you know, in terms of a campus, didn't have much to write home about. And then when I started working there, you know, I realized that it was actually all down to people. If you wanted to do great things at MIT, you could, because you had access to great people. But other than that, the classrooms weren't ideal. One of the classrooms that I used for teaching one of the courses was very oddly shaped. I remember every time I walked into that class, I would, you know, just think, who the hell designed this classroom? It was very oddly shaped. And I had to carry my projector and my laptop, and it snows often at, you know, in Boston. So, you know, just plodding in, what, 2 feet snow, carrying my laptop and projector and a portable projection screen to teach that class. Just, you know, every time I did that, it reminded me that there's nothing that makes MIT special other than the fact that it just has great people. And the environment is such that failure is encouraged. People are encouraged to do risky, edgy things. And beyond that, doesn't really do much. You know, so it's a pretty informal thing. There's no real structure that, you know, sort of forces you to excel in what you want to do. They choose well. It's a pretty, you know, tough selection process. And in that, just put lots of interesting people in one place, and that's all they do. So when I came back to LUMS, I firmly believed in this. I thought, you know, actually LUMS in many ways may have better facilities. I think the classrooms here were fabulous, very well designed and so on, and the campus was beautiful, and all the facilities were great. So there was no reason why we couldn't do MIT quality research from LUMS, and I've always believed that. And there's no reason why we can't have a little startup like Google coming out of Pakistan. Our people here are just as brilliant, just as committed, but they lack awareness and belief. And I think what I brought with me from MIT was this sense of belief, because I'd seen, you know, sort of the guy who had office next door to me, you know, had an island and a plane and had invented RSA, which is a big well-known security protocol. And two doors in that corridor was Anant Agarwal's office, and he's gone on to do reasonably well in his life as well. I just realized that these people are much like me, and it's just that, you know, they're surrounded by good, smart people, and there's no reason why you can't create that environment in Pakistan. Maybe I was just very optimistic or starry-eyed when I came back, but I've certainly not done as well as most MIT professors do. But I think, you know, it is certainly doable that you could certainly surround yourself by people who are smarter than you, who are very, very committed, and they are certainly available in ample quantities and abundantly available in a country like Pakistan. And that's all I've done. So I came back, everyone saw me as this professor coming from MIT, so hence must be smart and doing cool things, except that I fed off their ideas and enthusiasm. But I had this belief that you could do it in a rented building on Main Street, you could certainly do it in Lahore. And I think that's essentially what has happened. For most of the work that we've done in my research lab has had impact. We've been very focused on picking problems and solving them in ways that you know, real people use them before we write papers. And we've won a series of best paper awards in top venues in computer science. Most of the things that we've done have been used by thousands of people. One of the things that spun off into an SMS company that used by millions of people. So that's fantastic. And I think the kind of research that's now coming out of that is also just fascinating. And I'm surprised this had not been done to this scale in Pakistan before this. That's something that surprises me, honestly, because all the ingredients are here. You have smart, brilliant students to work with. The environment is very enabling. It's problem-rich. The local market is very large. Most of my research from, you know, mobile computing and embedded operating systems, I now work on what they call ICTD, which is using IT for development. And, you know, sort of I don't have to go looking for problems. Problems come looking for me. And if you find a decent solution, it will be immediately used by millions of people. So in some ways, sort of being here is a real blessing, because in my area of research, most of the staff, most of the problems and their solutions exist in this environment. And now I think my research group at LAMS has to be one of the top 10 research groups anywhere in the world in the area of ICTD.
I want to get back to your very interesting point about people, and that part of the, in fact, critical secret sauce of an organization, of a university like MIT, is that it brings together brilliant people who are risk takers, who want to change the world. You mentioned that when you returned to LAMS, you had equally brilliant people, but as you put it, they lacked awareness and belief. And I'm curious, what does the cultural change look like to bring the awareness and the belief? I benefit as an American who gotten to know a lot of Pakistanis. In fact, we were introduced by a common friend that we've both been very lucky to collaborate with, Idris Butt. So I certainly have seen the fruit of that, the turning on of the awareness and the belief. But I'm curious, actually, what was that like as you found people who were brilliant but didn't necessarily understand the path towards applying their smarts towards some risk-taking, some entrepreneurial adventures that perhaps hadn't been tried before?
Because I don't think I've thought about it much. It sort of happened organically. So I came back and got some lab space at LAMS and started work with students. And I'll be lying if I said all of them were MIT quality. You know, so MIT, you find people who are all very, very good. Here, you know, maybe 2 out of 5 are very, very good. And you just have to be willing to work with people and set very high standards, hold yourself to very high standards, but then set a very high bar for people that you work with. And I believe in that. And you know, so one thing that I tell people who work with me is that if you put in 1 ounce of effort, I promise 2 ounces of effort. But I will make sure that for as long as you work with me, you do not get more than 6 hours of sleep. And that is my commitment to you. So I think, you know, if sort of as kind of an academic leader or someone who's doing startups and so on, if you're willing to hold yourself to very high standards, and then ask everyone around you to also pull themselves up to that standard, I think most will step up to the plate and meet those goals. So before I came to LAMS, I think most people that I met were okay publishing in, let's say, second-tier conferences. Just that they've never tried publishing in a top-tier conference, never thought that it is possible. You come back and you tell them, well, you know, I've done that before. And it took 2 students, much like you, and about 6 months of work. And I think this is an idea that certainly can get into a top publication venue. So let's start working on it. And sure, you know, at times it's a hit or a miss, but eventually it comes through and eventually you find students who are committed and who get it and are willing to put in the hours that it takes. And along this route. And obviously, there are lots of aborted efforts, lots of failed little projects. But as I've told you, I've tried to sort of build my career around home runs. So every so often, you do kind of, stumble upon an idea or a little startup that, has traction, that people start using or that starts producing fundamentally new results. And it's sort of in many ways an organic process. And doesn't take much. All it takes is, here I am. I spent some time at MIT, so I understand how high quality research is done, how startups are done. And here are some of the ideas that I have. And not all of them are great, but guess what? People who work there are not very dissimilar to the people here. So let's start working on this and see where we get. And we pivot and we chisel on refining the ideas. And we go along and people come and go and eventually, you sort of, maybe you'll take a little longer than you would at a place in US, but eventually you'll get there. And I think, I'm beginning to now believe more and more that, if Estonia can do it and Austria can do it, then certainly Pakistan can as well.
I do want to turn now to some of the ideas that you and your colleagues have given birth to, some of these home runs. First of those home runs, I think, if I have the chronology correct, is CN Reports. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that idea and how it came about at a time when there was some media censorship in your country, and this became sort of an important counterbalance to that in some ways.
In my research life, I started working on a bigger problem of trying to just understand why we get such pathetic bandwidth in a country like Pakistan. And is there any way that one could try and address that? So just a whole series of projects that we did to try and make internet more accessible in a country like Pakistan. And if you look at the research work coming out of the lab, eventually it led to a BitTorrent client called BitMate, which is now used by about 40,000-50,000 people from 173 countries, and written a series of papers on various aspects of trying to solve that puzzle. And sort of in some ways became the first research-based home run. But in the process, I started working with students who were interested in both doing research, but stuff that people use and possible commercial enterprises. And most of the things, even a startup, start off with trying to solve a real problem in an interesting way. So what we started out doing initially was basically these two white students who were at the time were both teaching assistants with me at LAMS. I had started teaching a class on Lisp. I just believe that in Pakistan, we don't teach functional programming languages. I don't know if you have a tech background, but in Pakistan, people don't typically teach functional programming languages. They jump direct to something like Java or C#, which are imperative languages, and hence never kind of really understand the algorithmic background of it. At MIT, they used to teach Scheme and Lisp. At Cambridge, they taught Moscow ML. These are functional programming languages. So I taught a course in Scheme, and I found these two students who were generally interested in both learning the language because they had never learned this before and were very, very good at what they were doing. So they started working as teaching assistants with me. And one day, one of these guys came to me and said, I want to do a startup. And I think I gave him a flippant answer. What I told him was that startup is not a part-time job. It needs about 18 hours of your time for several years, and you'll have to do this full-time. Otherwise, you shouldn't do it. And he said, all right. And at that time, he was doing a part-time teaching assistant assignment for me. Also, I was working elsewhere. About, I think, 2 weeks later, he came to me and said, I've given up my job, and I now want to do my startup. And I said, good grace. This guy really listened to me. And that time, I was so taken aback. He had taken my advice so seriously, and he was so committed that I didn't even ask him, what is it that he wants to work on? I said, whatever you want to work on, you will have my full support, whatever resources you need, just go ahead and make it happen. And I think a week later, we finally discussed the idea. He wanted to make something very similar to Google Mapmaker. But while he was still toying with that idea, Google released Mapmaker. And then he again started looking for direction. But in the meanwhile, he had convinced two of his friends to also join his startup. And then they came to me looking for an idea. And at the time, Musharraf, who was that time was the military general running the country, had imposed a ban on all media. And there was a political movement going on in Pakistan to restore the judiciary and to restore media. And that was picking up pace, except that the international media or the local media was not allowed to report on it. So I had these three kids, uber programmers, very, very committed and starry-eyed. So I said, let's make something to which people can send pictures to, ordinary people, and we'll start publishing it online. sort of be like an online newspaper, except that people will start reporting updates from eyewitness accounts of this lawyers movement that's going on. And we literally put up a website in about half a day, I think, and then people started, you know, sending updates to it. Soon, lawyers were doing this long march, so to speak, where they were getting on buses and going from one city to the other. We got these conflicts treated and bought some, I think, phones or some SIMs and taught people how to send MMS messages so they can take pictures on their cell phones and start sending us MMS pictures, which we'll start publishing on this website. And hence was born See and Report. You know, you report whatever you see. And that was that. And we showed people how to use this. And people started sending us pictures. We started publishing them on CN Report. And soon, you know, sort of we started getting requests from BBC and France 24/7 for syndicating our pictures because there was nothing else coming out of Pakistan. And we had all these traditional media houses, and media is a big business, getting very wary of this new little thing that has come up where it is becoming to be a credible news source. So at the end of that lawyers' long march, we had a CN Report established as a citizen journalism service in Pakistan, and we're getting regular requests for content from international newspapers. And we had local media finally wake up to the fact that media is going through a transformation, and it is becoming more and more people-centric. And I remember getting a call from the CEO of one of the TV channels called Samar TV, who said, you know, this is a great service. Can we license this platform off? And at that point, we'd made something that was useful. We were very proud of it. It solved a real problem. But we'd not thought of monetizing it. So we went to meet with this guy. And he said, and I told him about the service and so on. He said, you know, thank you for all your fascinating stories about citizen journalism, but I'm already sold. He'd done this course, I think, from Stanford in innovation journalism or something. So he was totally sold on the idea. So he said, just tell me how much I need to pay you. And at the time, you know, we didn't know how to price it. I didn't know how to price it. So I looked at the three co-founders that I had and hesitantly sort of just said, $2,000 per month. And he said, all right, done. So I sent him the report. So it was, so he said, I think that's $2,000, which was enough, the three co-founders that I had, to start drawing some salary. And then we started working on that platform. That platform eventually led to a requirement that MMS itself is not sufficient because of the size limitations for sending high quality footage. So we need to have a mobile application that people can use to send us a better quality footage. And then quickly, there was a requirement that if you have mobile applications that people are using for sending in their updates, why not also start sending out news on that mobile application? And then eventually, that led to the idea that citizens are sending us great pictures and reports, but what we really also want is our reporters sending us live video streams of breaking news stories, which we otherwise won't be able to cover, maybe from their cell phone. Then we started, you know, working on a cell phone client. But if you could come up with even a device that aggregates bandwidth of multiple network channels out in the wild, and I can start getting some real-time footage of these breaking news stories, that would be cool. So therefore, the idea evolved from a citizen journalism web-based service to a pretty sophisticated mobile presence to now a new device that these guys have developed. It's a hardware little box that you could connect multiple network devices to, wireless network devices to. It aggregates their bandwidth and lets you live stream video. And this device, even though, and excuse me for the slight bias that I might have, is actually better than any other device made anywhere else in the world, both in terms of the price, but also what it can do. It does encoding in software. It can leverage up to 12 a wide area of wireless network channels. It actually delivers broadcast quality video. So we end up competing with hardware vendors, and these are serious companies from all over the world, and beat them in the local market, and they're selling these devices. And each device is about arbitrage of about 3 to 4 times of what it costs us to build one. So we need to just sell a handful to have a decent revenue stream. And we've sold a handful already for the election coverage in Pakistan. And we pivoted from one thing to the other, but sort of in many ways, it really has also evolved with the requirements that we were thrown at by these media companies. And one of our co-founders eventually left the company and started pursuing grad school, and the other co-founder has stayed with it. And it is a company that continues to grow in directions that I didn't anticipate, and have become like a hardware company, and is doing reasonably well.
That's fantastic. I'd like to move to an idea that you've already talked about a little bit, which is SMSall. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the genesis of that idea as well as the evolution that it has taken.
SMSall actually has a long history. I was in Pakistan trying to help out with the relief efforts once, many, many years ago in 2005, and put together a small sort of a group SMS service so that people can coordinate their activities by sending broadcast messages. Eventually, when I came back to LAMS and started teaching there, I very quickly realized that our email system is up and down. And if I wanted to send students updates on classes that need to be rescheduled or quizzes that need to be announced, I needed some other framework to communicate with them. So I had two freshmen who had just taken their introductory course of programming with me. And came to me at the end of that course saying that we like programming. How can we improve our programming skills? So I said, work on an independent project over the summers, and that's the best way to learn programming, by doing it. So they said, okay, do you have a project that we can work on? And I said, the problem that I'm facing at LAMS is that I can't communicate with my students in a timely fashion to reschedule classes, to announce quizzes, programming assignments, and so on. What I want to do is build a small service that lets you set up a group on SMS, similar to like a mailing list, except that works over SMS. I said, let's buy a cell phone and connect it to a desktop. The cell phone will receive the SMS, will look up a database of people registered, and will send a broadcast SMS to the people registered on that channel. And we started working on that. They were freshmen. They took about 3 months to complete the project. And then the code also went through many stages of evolution. And initially, I started using it for my class. Then we opened it up such that other people can make groups. So you could send an SMS and make a group, and other people can then join your group all over SMS. And we had one cell phone connected to a desktop. 2 months into the project, we had thousands of people using it, hundreds of thousands of SMSs going through. A year into the project, we had a whole part of the lab dedicated to the cell phones connected to many machines that were sending millions of SMSs for tens of thousands of people outside of LAMS in cities that I had at least never heard of. So there was certainly a lot of pent-up demand for people to communicate with other people, and there was no way to do it in Pakistan. See, this is a country where only about 10% people have access to the internet and use Twitter or Facebook and would want to communicate with other people who share similar interests. So there was a system that would enable them to do it. Then NGOs started using it, political parties started using it. It was used heavily again in the political protests that were coordinated at the end of the Musharraf era, and it sort of just kept growing. And when sort of people saw that this little idea has become so successful, other people started copying it. But it's easy to copy, it's a simple idea. I want to say deceptively simple in the sense that, once you really get into it, there is a lot of bells and whistles that you want to get right. So a lot of people tried copying it. Actually, someone who was very close to the company at that time copied the idea and then also commercialized it in Pakistan. So my students were disheartened. We had a service that was doing reasonably well. I was putting in some fraction of my professorial salary to buy airtime credit on the cell phones that were connected to the desktop so that I can start sending, I was sending SMSs for free for people. And I did that, I think, for about 2 years. We would buy these prepaid scratch cards, would load up our SIMs in these cell phones every day, and would send out free SMSs for people trying to communicate with each other. And in the meanwhile, someone had commercialized the service, exactly the same idea, and my students were very disheartened. They kept telling me, why don't we monetize it or scale it to a different level? And I just didn't have the heart to pull the plug on the service because so many good people were using it for so many interesting things. But even though frowned upon someone else copying our idea and monetizing it, but you can't really begrudge people for being good entrepreneurs or executing good entrepreneurial ideas. And we sort of meandered along. This went on, I think, for about 2.5, 3 years. And then the students were about to also graduate, and they wanted to move to greener pastures, one of whom went to Harvard to pursue graduate school. And the other guy, who was one of the main guys working on this, started working for the World Bank on using similar ideas for improving public sector performance. And he was really excited and passionate about it. So I wasn't left with much choice. The students eventually, lost enthusiasm for sending free SMSs for people on a service that we didn't monetize. and I eventually pulled the plug on the service. At the time, it was called Chopal, which is a place in a village in Punjab where people come together and chit-chat. And I sort of almost given up on this. I was doing other things, CN Report. I had another little startup called Bumpin, and I was focused on them on my research career and just kind of moved on. But then two entrepreneurs, just recent students, approached me, one of whom is a mutual friend, Adris Bhatt. One of the most committed, enthusiastic people I have ever come across. He scares me with his ambition and commitment, and I just hope that I can keep up with him. And Waqas Farooq, who was an Uber techie. So these two people came and met with me and said, you know, we want to do a startup with you. We discussed many things. Actually, at that time, I was interested in key value stores, similar to things that like Cloudera and MapReduce and so on, because I was doing research on them and I thought, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for commercializing this work. So I gave them an idea like this, which they also worked on for a couple of weeks. And then the other idea they discussed was to somehow resurrect Chopal. It was close to my heart, and part of me sort of died when I pulled the plug in the service. And I wanted to resurrect it and make it a successful, scalable service. So these two guys started working on it. And I think for the first 2 months, we almost worked with a sense of vengeance where we thought other people have stolen our ideas and have done better than us, and we really need to show them. And we spent many nights just rewriting code, meeting with telecom operators, figuring out a way to monetize it without burdening the users or precluding the use only to people who can afford an expensive value-added service. And at the end, I think about a two-month, you know, just a hyperdrive 2 months, we finally made the service live one day before Eid, which is a festival similar to Christmas, and launched the service again on a paid shortcode where people can come and buy sort of SMS All currency. We changed the name of the service from Chopal to SMS All. It was easier to remember and recognize. And we launched some shortcodes with all five telecom operators, and the service again started growing. Now, one thing I failed to mention is that when these two entrepreneurs wanted to do a startup with me and we were discussing ideas, when SMS All or Chopal came up, you know, I told them that the service is dead and buried, and they said, okay, but let's see if we can resurrect it. And they connected the network cable back to the machine on which the original Chopal code was running. And on the first day, we sent close to 2 million SMSs. First day. The service was down for 2 months. We literally connect the service back to the internet. 2 million messages first day. It didn't take us much to then sort of very quickly realize that there's an opportunity here to have impact. And we pursued it with all the vigor that we had and continue to do it till today. And SMS All consumes more time than any of the startup that I'm doing currently. And they've sort of continued to improve it, continued to pivot from idea to idea. It started out as a group messaging service. We very quickly realized how to build meaningful conversational SMSs is a non-trivial problem. So there's a lot of backer intelligence that goes into the system. There's also a community of users. It's a consumer-based social network. So you have to understand your consumers. You have to respond to their requirements, anticipate that what might nudge this community in a direction which both, you know, is monetizable but doesn't kill the social aspect of this. And there's a social bottom line to this company. You know, we occasionally call people up. And Adris does this with a lot of joy. He occasionally calls people up who run large communities in SMS All. This works a lot like Twitter, except that it will make community. So, you know, he would pick up the phone and call one of the guys who runs a community of 30,000 people. And here's a guy who lives in the middle of absolutely nowhere. We've never heard of this place in Pakistan. It can barely read and write, you know, but runs a group of 30,000 people and sends them timely updates on news alerts. Guy who, you know, lives in a small city and runs a group for blood donations on a certain blood group type, which is very rare. You know, so there are uses of this service that if this didn't exist, these use cases would also not exist. You know, this guy in Chagi, which is a place that I've never been to in Pakistan, would not be able to communicate with 30,000 people if this did not exist. So there's a social bottom line to this, which, you know, sort of just excites us every day that we think about it. And then, you know, while we were doing all of this, and SMS All was going through a phase of rapid growth, we were finally contacted by political parties. The election was just coming up, and one of the new entrants in politics was a charismatic cricketer,
yes,
Imran Khan, who was looking for ways in which he can run a membership drive for his new political party. And Adris was contacted, and he proposed that you could do it over SMS. And it seemed like a very practical idea. You know, why don't you in your speech, say, anyone who wants to support me or join your political party, just send an SMS on a short code. And then I'll have your cell phone number, and I can then get back to you with status updates, with how our political movement is coming along. And that's essentially what has happened. He announced this, I think, in one of his political gatherings. And in about 3 days, he had about 20,000 followers. And now I think he has about close to 3.5 million followers on SMSOL, which is about 60-70% of his entire vote bank, given that now we know how many people have voted for him. So this became a really potent channel for him to get people enrolled in his party and to keep them updated and engaged with this new political movement that he was trying to build. And certainly, other political parties very quickly realized the power of this medium, and they all started making their own channels on SMSOL. So I think that the party that currently won the elections also runs an equally large SMS channel on SMSOL and has also very effectively utilized this platform. Other political parties are now hopping on board as well. And this is sort of becoming the medium on which, we would like to say the elections were fought. This is where these political parties were mobilizing their vote banks up until the last day, asking them to get their votes registered, telling them where they need to go and cast their vote, giving them updates on political activities of their party in their neighborhood. This was used very, very effectively by the parties that have done well in the elections. So I think technology was actually sort of a silent winner that not a lot of people know about outside of Pakistan, but technology played a huge role in Pakistan, especially the SMS platform. And in the process, you pivot from idea to idea, and as we're trying to figure out how to do social networking mobile, it's certainly not a problem that we are thinking about alone in Pakistan. It is a problem that Facebook is thinking about, it's a problem that Twitter is thinking about. And I don't think anyone's really cracked this puzzle on how to monetize a social network on a mobile device. And the pace has really heated up. It just so happened that we've been sort of banging our head against this wall for about 4 years now and have lots of good ideas and a fairly large network on which we can experiment with these ideas. So the reason Vikas came up with this idea of doing something similar to hashtags on Twitter or SMS. So they seemingly look Twitter hashtags, but they work very differently. You send an SMS, include a hashtag in it. And we, from our community, and it's a large community, you know, more than 5 million, 6 million people on SMSOR, we pick the ones who we think are most likely to communicate on this idea with you and send your SMS to them. And the ones who respond to you automatically form a little community, temporal community, you know, sort of a temporary community on which they then discuss this idea and then move on. So this could be, the hashtag could be a constituency in which you're going to vote for someone. It could be a news item that just came out. It could be a game of cricket or baseball that's going on, and so on and so forth. So it could be big or small. It works a lot like hashtag on Twitter, except it works over SMS, so you have to keep the group small for meaningful conversations, and you have to make it such that it's difficult to spam on this, that you can recommend people who may be good participants in a conversation like this, that you can infer and recommend topics that are similar to the current conversation going on. So there's a lot of back-end sophisticated processing that goes on to support a service where people are just talking to each other. We are inferring their interests. We are inferring their social connections and constantly recommending to them to build these social interactions on a medium which is really simple, SMS. It's not like Facebook where the medium is very rich. So on this very simple medium, we have to build this. So now we have, based on this SMS idea that sort of has communities large and small, has hashtags, has a very strong corporate interface, which works a lot like a customer relationship management platform. And in a country like Pakistan, for let's say a large retail outlet, the CRM has to be SMS-based. Because remember, Pakistan is the ninth largest market of cell phones anywhere in the world, with 120 million cell phones. And also, Pakistan is the fourth largest texting country in the world. Pakistanis sent 253 billion SMS just last year. So anything in Pakistan that wants to reach out to a large group of people inevitably has to use SMS. So the platform that we've built on the web that large corporations, enterprises use to coordinate their sales forces or to talk to their customers is a full-blown CRM with a very strong component of SMS in it. We also have an IVR platform built on top of that for taking conversations on SMS to voice conversations. It was also used effectively by, again, by political parties for sending messages to their voters using IVR calls to tell their voters to come out and vote for them. And now we are finally moving towards mobile applications, which is a space that is heating up all over the world. I don't think anyone's really cracked this puzzle. Look at the Twitter mobile client or the Facebook mobile client or Path or Viber or WhatsApp. And I think we have a good sense of what works on mobile and what doesn't. And we've been at this mobile app for about a year now on how to make it simple, scalable, and monetizable. And I think we are largely there. We are going to release our first mobile application, Android and iPhone, I think about 3 to 4 weeks from now. And I think it will open up fundamentally new opportunities for interaction on SMS all. We are expanding to other international markets. One of the largest media companies in Pakistan, JioTV, has bought some stake in the company, so they've put all of their media muscle behind it. So we're hoping to make SMS all now a household brand in Pakistan and are now going to experiment with functionality on top of this. But in all of this, SMS all for me is a byproduct of the opportunity to work with two very exciting entrepreneurs. And ideas come and go, and we'll keep iterating and keep evolving and improving the service. But as long as, you know, we have the same enthusiasm working on this startup, I think we'll get somewhere.
That's a very impressive story. Thank you for sharing it in such depth. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about your ideas about trends. As you look to the future, say 3 or 5 years out, what particularly excites you? What sorts of transformations are you monitoring with more than a little interest?
There's one that we talked about offline, which is the education space. Education as we know it, enrolling in college, turning up in a classroom, sitting through a lecture, it's not going to be like that 5 years from now. So this is one space that is going through a fundamental rethink with the Khan Academy, with edX, with Udacity, Coursera. This thing is going to be fundamentally different to what we know of education today. Just the mode of delivery, how people consume instructional content, how you monetize such content, how people acquire diplomas or degrees, how employers view them, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a space that I'm very closely monitoring. It's a space that I'm always remain excited about, wanting to do something interesting. The other space that is going through a fundamental rethink is the media space. As you know, print media is dying everywhere in the world. Media is big business. It's both profitable and, you know, media people are big power brokers. Just an anecdote, power of media for media outlet owners is as important as monetization. Not everyone does it for money. So, for instance, the guy who does Washington Post sinks as much money in Washington Post as he makes from Kaplan, the testing service. So people are willing to lose money in this industry so that they get their viewers, their readers, their perspective on events. So I think it's a very exciting industry, but an industry that is going through a full rethink. News media is dying out. I think there's going to be more and more citizen-focused, user-centric media. That's going to be mobile or web, no one knows. How are you going to monetize this is a big question. No one's really cracked that puzzle. No one's begun to monetize online news as much as they could print news. Print news was hugely profitable. You know, whether it will be citizen journalism, whether it will be user-generated content, whether it will be Twitter would be the new CNN, who knows. For instance, I get all my breaking news stories on Twitter without a fault. So how big a role social media would have in this, how the two-screen issue where, you know, you're watching news but also looking at your laptop will interplay with this. So I think these are two spaces. There's a lot of room for innovation, but large enterprises, sort of the same opportunity that I think Microsoft had when you had household PCs come up. It's the same opportunity that Facebook had when there was social networking being made accessible to common people. I think, you know, these two opportunities will also lead to similar scale companies.
As an educator, as a prominent academic in your country, can we go back to the education one just briefly? How do you see personally or LUMS generally using some of the technologies or offerings of companies like the Courseras or Udacities or edX's of the world? How do you see the interplay between the traditional education experience at LUMS, for instance, and leveraging these technologies, these companies' offerings?
Well, we're very early in this solution that's coming up in the education space. I think Pakistan Society, we haven't really started using it as much as we should. Pakistan has a virtual university, which is two TV channels in which they deliver lectures. These are sort of largely monologues, non-interactive TV lectures. and it's been reasonably successful. But I think there'll be a lot of excitement at the primary, secondary level, and then eventually excitement at the college level. In Pakistan, we haven't really started using it. We've just started maybe university, by the way. I'm transitioning our alums to become a vice chancellor of a new university we've set up called the ITU, the Information Technology University. And in that, I'm actually hoping to be in phase with some of the course offerings on Udacity or edX. As you know, we deliver the same instruction material as they would be in edX. So they'd sit through a class in ITU University. The instructor follows the same content that the edX course is doing, let's say at MIT. And at the end of it, they get both a certificate from edX and then credits for the course that they've taken here. So maybe universities will sort of start aligning themselves in the short term with these course offerings from these top-notch universities. And maybe students will have an opportunity also benchmark themselves, both the quality of content being delivered to them, but also whether they can get the certification from edX's and Coursera's and so on.
Well, Dr. Umar Seif, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you today. I appreciate you sharing so many insights from your experience, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Likewise, it's a pleasure talking to you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the power of openness and shared knowledge to transform how we all do business. Learn more at redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.